Welcome to Manager Tools. My directs are too busy, part two. And the questions this cast answers are, what do I do when my directs say they're too busy? Should I protect my directs when they say they're too busy? And is busyness a legitimate defense? If you'd like answers to these questions and more, keep listening. Is your organization going through a growth spurt? Or maybe you're not growing, but you're looking at maturing your internal processes in order to ensure you hire the best candidates. Because let's face it, as an organization, we all want to hire the best people. Why? Because we want a world where we don't have to interview again when that individual proves themselves not a good fit for the organization. We want our managers' lives to be easier because managing people who struggle at their jobs is just plain harder. We want to work with and communicate with an individual who's right on track with what we expect for our employees in our organization. If you're interested in talking to us about how we can come on site or bring to your team virtually the effective hiring manager training, please send us an email to customerservice@manager-tools.com and we can talk about how to help you and your team make the best hires.
Okay, we've covered some of the business rationales. Let's talk about appropriate managerial strategies to address these things. First, keep in mind, I touched on this earlier, that FUEs and UEs, all these other random busyness invokers, they do truly believe that they're fully busy. Mm-hmm.
They feel like that.
And that is largely because of the hours they work. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is ask them why they think they're busy, and they'll go right to the number of hours that they're working. And it's ironic because for all but your top performers, they know that they don't just dare leave work early if they figured out how to get all their work done.
Right.
Because they'll be sending a signal that they have available work hours yet to be captured. So they do their work in such a way that it takes up all their hours. And then they tell you that they're busy. So they come to work and they do 8 hours, the same as somebody else, let's say.
And they don't get everything done because none of us get all of our work done every day. So they're like, I'm leaving after 8 hours. I still have a bunch of stuff I haven't done yet.
And even if they do get everything done and they could leave at 3, they don't.
Right.
Which means that the person who stays 8 hours and works that whole 8 hours or honestly gets twice as much done in 8 hours, they feel busy too. And the truth is one of them is busier than the other while they're both spending the same amount of time at work.
That's exactly it. Folks, this probably reminds you of or sounds familiar. It's basically a version of Parkinson's law. That is, work expands to fill the time available for it. Many directs, especially those who are most likely to invoke the busyness defense, simply deny their managers more time for more work by saying they are busy. The more generalist version of Parkinson's law explains why the demand upon resources tends to expand to match the supply of the resources if the price is zero. This applies because the price of your direct's time is zero relative to them working full and regular hours. We don't have to pay more for more work getting done during normal hours, but our directs control their supply of work output and use this busyness as the defense.
And if you're interested in this Parkinson's Law Wikipedia page, there's also Horstman's Corollary, which is work contracts to fit the time we give it. And this is the first managerial approach to addressing busyness. Efficiency. Yay. And I love efficiency.
I know.
I love it. And I don't want to sacrifice effectiveness. However, we're going to push for more work output by asking our directs to figure out how to get their existing work done in less time, which will then allow them to do more in a full day.
Exactly. The number of hours don't change, but if you get more work done, you're being more effective, generally.
Right. Maximizing output.
Yeah, exactly. And the second of the three core managerial approaches to busyness is prioritization. Often, managers see busyness claims as resistance to change. And it obviously is. I mean, absolutely, it's a resistance to change. Comfort comes with a coefficient of static friction, which is always less than the coefficient of dynamic friction. Those who change more easily than those who resist change.
And seeing it as resistance to change gives managers almost no tools to combat the problem, other than to, you know, rail against their stubbornness, which, of course, they'll resist.
Stubbornly.
Yeah, pretty
seriously. Because why wouldn't they?
Yeah. But the thing is, and I have to attribute some of this, a lot of this, in directs. If I'm going for the benefit of the doubt and assumption of positive intent, this is just professional immaturity. It's just a lack of understanding of what it means to let your work expand to fit the hours when you could, in fact, compress it and get more out. But the direct who claims busyness to avoid new or different work, which is something they're doing, whether they realize it or not, inappropriately, like, decided for herself the decision of what work should be done.
Yeah.
So they've taken responsibility for choosing work, for task assignment, upon themselves. And another way to say that is her behavior effectively states, nothing you're asking me to do is more important than the things that I'm already doing. And it's a rejection of new work.
Yeah.
Often without even knowing enough about this new work, this stuff that we're trying to hand over, to compare its value to existing work. And so rejection of the new is used as a way to protect the existing work. And unfortunately, it's the work is the important part, not the, I want to keep doing the same thing.
Right.
And so continuing to do the same thing actually takes control over the prioritization of work. So your directs are taking from you the decisions around
about what's the most important thing that needs to be done by us in our organization.
That is not how it works.
That is not how it works.
Prioritization is always ultimately the manager's decision.
Exactly. And folks, sure, directs get to make tactical decisions regarding prioritization of their work on a day-to-day basis based on deadlines that have shifted and whatever else might come along.
But sure.
Directs do not get to completely control their prioritization of the work, excluding any new inputs regarding timing or relative value, and especially so if those inputs or timings come from their boss. Asking your direct to change what they're working on, adding new work, eliminating or reducing existing work in relative priority is fundamental to the nature of role power and cannot be ignored or reasonably resisted by a direct. It is a fundamental managerial approach. Your directs are not responsible for prioritizing the organization's work. You're responsible for prioritizing it for them, and them saying no to work is them taking from you your responsibility for prioritizing their work. Mm-hmm. They can't say no to work if they don't even know its relative importance to what they're currently working on, without them having taken the reins of prioritization, which goes against everything that is organizationally true.
Mm-hmm. I had an interesting conversation about this week, actually, though. So Adam, if you're listening, you should know, if you've tried multiple times to get the prioritization from the levels above you and they've not given you any, decide for yourself and then ask your boss about it and then take it to your directs. You're the manager, don't forget. And the third and final approach to the busyness defense is the imperative of change. It is a high-level, even strategic approach, which makes the argument that if the organization is changing, by definition, the parts of the organization, its constituent parts, must also change. This, of course, is undeniable, and perhaps our directs, again, just professionally immature, forget that this is true. Nevertheless, even though it is undeniable, we have seen directs deny it, not at the theory level, rather at the day-to-day, I don't like that rule. I don't like that rule is being applied to me. I am the exception. And if you have done this in your past, I'm not mad at you. I just want you to know these are organizational things that not everybody knows.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Not even all managers know, to be honest.
Right.
So I mean, why would all directs?
we wouldn't be here. So if you didn't know this until now, don't feel badly. It's not always something that is talked about or discussed. And now you know. Now you know that when the organization wants to move into new areas, new contracts, new ideas, new products, change has to happen from the top all the way down. And those changes require changes in people's work on a daily basis. They also require elimination of work that isn't useful to the new approach, the new initiative. And y'all, the market is always growing. So the organization has to grow or die. And it can be helpful when you talk to your directs, when you use this approach, letting your resistant direct know, hey, everybody else in the team's workload is changing as well. It's not just you. And honestly, if you wanted to prep for it, you could even address it in a staff meeting, because it's maybe sometimes more palatable to say these things in front of everybody. Hey, we have this new set of initiatives, so that's going to cause some changes in workload. That way, the direct, each direct,
yeah,
knows that it's happening to everyone. And so they might be more willing.
Yeah. And you can assume they don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, especially if you didn't know till today, why would they know?
It's also hard because I don't know that the people who've used these techniques successfully, most of them I find have used these techniques of the business defense for a long time. They're entrenched in it. And so I don't know that the staff meeting announcement is necessarily going to
resonate
them.
Necessarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this ain't about me.
Yeah.
That classic.
Right. And just something that I find people who use these defense mechanisms have used them successfully for a long time. And the trench that they're in, the foxhole that they're in, is deep.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So we've done theory, we've done derivation.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start to apply our knowledge to different situations. So let's start with the too busy for one-on-ones defense. If you're a Manager Tools community member, you've probably fully implemented or tried to implement or at least have been thinking about the implementation of one-on-ones. And if you've tried, whether you've succeeded or whether you've failed, at least one and perhaps more of your directs invoked the too busy for one-on-ones defense. Now, they could have been both fewies and ewies amongst your troops. It wasn't one or the other necessarily. It could have been, frankly, both at this point. And in light of what we've just shared, and therefore you've just learned, which approaches work best? In our experience, based on watching hundreds of thousands of managers implement one-on-ones, and we would recommend using all of these approaches together.
Okay. And because we're usually so direct, you might be wondering why. The answer is because the nature of great managerial success relies on relationship power versus role or expertise power. And that power stems directly from trust. So if you get one-on-ones right, you will become trusted and everything else will be easier. You can use the other parts of the manager tools trinity a la carte. The going will be much slower though when you attempt to do so without trust. It's worth it to bet a lot of your chips on the value of manager tools one-on-ones.
Yeah, I mean, trust goes a long way toward your ability to just have those conversations and have them, to your previous point, Kate, be accepted by other people on the team, right? I trust her, but she's saying probably isn't complete rubbish. So how might it sound? Let's say Clark, your direct Clark, has sent you a private email saying he's too busy for one-on-ones. Rather than responding with an email, even if that's their preferred style of communication, we would suggest you schedule with him a 30-minute meeting to discuss your plans. Now, with all the irony that you could possibly muster, Clark's going to end up scheduling 30 minutes to defend his unwillingness to change, even though the very scheduling of this meeting proves he is willing to change as long as he's the one who's deciding what he wants to use his 30 minutes for. So he can find 30 minutes for the things he wants to find 30 minutes for, just not the 30 minutes for the things you want him to find the time for the 30 minutes.
Right, but we're going to do it anyway. We're going to look at his calendar for the remainder of the week or early next week, pick a time that shows him as available, and send a meeting notification.
Mm-hmm.
You may choose to include this comment, which is, this is important enough that I want to discuss it face-to-face or on Zoom. Looking forward to it. And in the meeting, you'll do better if you ask Clark to lay out his objections to one-on-ones first. it will probably sound like, I'm too busy and I don't think I need it and I'm really busy. Except with, like, more words.
So many more words.
Mm-hmm. Right. Again, ironic, since he's trying here in this meeting to make a case that he doesn't have time.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, folks, what we have next is a script. I'm going to read a script of what you might say as a manager in response to, in this case, Clark's concern. If you're a licensee, I would recommend you print off these show notes. This is quite a lengthy script, and you can have it in front of you while you have your conversation with your version of a Clark. But here we go. So, what you might say in response to this defense is, there are several reasons I want to go forward with this. The first one I'll mention is efficiency or productivity growth. The fact is, we're all asked to do more work over time. Jobs don't stay static, where any one of us can deny the organization the opportunity to expect more work in the same amount of time. Now, we're a humane organization, so we don't try and drive a truck through that principal's loophole. Individually, managers are allowed, though, that word is a bit soft, to ask for more capability from folks because folks get better at their work over time. That's one of the reasons companies try to grow without hiring more employees. Because of growth of existing capability, existing employees expanding their skills, spending less on the tasks because of their increased ability, frees them up for new work, which is what I'm suggesting. Our one-on-one be a new work meeting once a week, only 30 minutes, and that'll mean you figuring out ways to get the rest of your work done in a slightly, and let's be honest, ever so slightly, getting it done in less time than you presently do. Now, the second reason I'll mention is the foundational rules for how organizational priorities get decided. Generally, everyone here has a good deal of individual discretion regarding accomplishing their own work, though, as mentioned above, on a path towards greater efficiency. But managers, and that's me, are given the responsibility of assessing the validity of the prioritization and are given the authority to change it in the interests of the firm. Your interest in not doing one-on-ones is basically an argument about how important they are, and you're assigning them a priority value of zero. But your discretion is not without my oversight. And in this case, I put them at a high enough priority that they make it into our calendars. To be blunt, you don't get total authority to decide what you do and don't, unless you were to choose to quit over a 30-minute weekly meeting, which seems extreme. Third, you and I both know there's an imperative of change that is accepted here. No matter how much we like doing what we're doing today, that can easily and rapidly change based on input from the market, our customers, our competitors, our leadership, the markets, my boss, their boss, etc. I believe what's coming in the future is going to stretch us all, and I want us to have a solid foundation of trust going forward, and building trust isn't rocket science, and it takes time and attention. Finally, I want to mention two things about what we're going to do, and I intend to do going forward with one-on-ones, even if you disagree, as sometimes happens. That show how small a drop in the bucket these meetings are. First, I know that part of your concern is how busy you are. I looked at your calendar and you have a lot going on. And folks, small segue, you might not want to say that if their calendar's perfectly empty, just a heads up. But that's your calendar for this week and next. I'm not trying to change your calendar or priorities or efficiency now. I've looked at your calendar 5 weeks from now, and it's wide open. All the work you're doing has different priorities, and this is one more piece of work prioritized highly enough to require 30 minutes on your calendar 5 weeks from now. We have time to get ready. Second, I think we have to be honest about what we're going to be doing. This meeting is 30 minutes once a week. If you only work 40 hours a week, the 30-minute meeting with me is only 1.25% of your calendar. And if you work 50 hours a week, and I know sometimes you do, we're only talking about 1% of your calendar. These are rounding error numbers. We spend more time walking to meetings or deleting worthless emails than 30 minutes each week, to say nothing of the fact that the average estimate of waste for most professionals in a week is 30%. That's 15 hours out of a 50-hour week. This one-on-one isn't a burden, and it'll pay dividends for both of us. I hope these thoughts will help you come to our first one-on-one with a good attitude, or at least a neutral one, and we can build on that.
Yep. The 1.25% thing gets me every time.
I know.
And my experience with it is that it's engineers. My most often experience with people saying no is engineers. And the times that I've said to them, this is less than 1.5% of your week, and watched them realize they didn't do the math, it's really fun. It's super fun. It's a little Machiavellian, I understand.
But it's true. It's math.
They didn't do the math before they came to me and said they were busy. I know. That's the thing that
kills
me.
And you did, and no one thinks you did.
You came to me to tell me. And I honestly believe that people spend more than 1% of their week getting coffee. And I'm not even trying to take away your coffee. I just want to be clear that you tried to use a defense about time, which is based in numbers, and you didn't do the math before you used the defense.
Which, if you do it, it becomes immediately silly. I mean, you just look silly. I'm so sorry, but you do. You look silly. Fighting over 1.25% of your workload in a week. It's laughable.
Watching their face when they realize. Okay, so that's how we recommend you communicate your settled decision to do Manage Your Tools one-on-ones. These are powerful reasons, and they mark a professional approach versus the average amateur manager, the average manager saying, well, I'm just going to do it. Which brings us to delegation. People are too busy for delegation, which is a different situation than one-on-ones. Yeah. We recommend you insist on one-on-ones, as we said earlier. And if you have heard our model for delegation, you have heard the Manager Tools model for delegation is a relationship-based ask.
Yeah, rather not a statement, than a question.
Right. It's rather than using your role power to tell them. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing this whole cast. So since we're delving into underlying organizational principles, it's worth reviewing the difference from a conceptual point of view. First, and you may have heard this from us, some people in Ottawa heard it from me this week, there's three types of power. There's role power, which represents about 10% of your ability to achieve results. Relationship power, which is worth about 85% of your results ability. And expertise power, which is 5%. Relationship power is why people care who plays golf with the CEO. And expertise power is why, in my experience, engineers go to meetings so that they can be the smartest person in the room. And okay, role power exists. We agree.
Yeah.
And there are times we use it as above when we ask our directs to attend one-on-ones, regardless of their preference. It is not the end all and be all that inexperienced managers think it will be. I know somebody who wants to be a manager. And they said to me probably 8 months ago, Kate, I really want to be a manager. I think about it. I just think, it's going to be great. You know, I'll be a manager and I'll have a team and I'll tell them what to do and they'll do it.
Yeah. Good luck.
I didn't want to crush their dreams.
I don't.
You know? Well, so I said,
it every week, dude.
No offense. But this is like a friend and it was a Saturday.
Right. It's a Saturday.
Yeah, we're at their house. I'm just not trying to be mean in your own home. So I said, I can see why people sometimes want to be managers. That's what
I know.
And I was grateful that, you know, they were more talking to talk rather than they weren't listening too much. So it was okay. So role power and relationship power.
Exactly. And they each have different primary modes of asserting one's power. When a manager uses role power, she invokes the power of the organization, which the organization has rightly granted her, though it is limited. In fact, role power is a very specific thing. It means the right to speak with the power of the organization. It's linked conceptually to the idea that a direct cannot ask for confidentiality, because when a direct is speaking to their boss, they're speaking to, by definition, a representative of their organization. So you can see where this is a necessary logical corollary, two bosses speaking to us with the power of the firm.
And when a manager invokes role power in assigning tasks or work or making decisions about priorities, which we sometimes do and recommend, as with one-on-ones, he or she tells the direct what to do or how things are going to happen. This is a necessary part of managerial power and best used, honestly, sparingly. The boss who only uses role power misses out truly on the power of trust and has a much smaller kit bag to throw and use to increase effectiveness in your team. It's just, it's a lot less useful because it's funny, isn't it? The people assume role power is so big, and once you use it, you realize it's quite small.
Yeah, and the when more you have use it, you're like, oof.
The smaller it is.
Mine's broken.
It's really,
there's kind of that moment when you become a manager, you're like, wait a minute, they don't just do what you ask them to do? I mean, every time my boss has ever asked me to do something, I've done that thing. You mean you can't just ask the people on your team to do it and they'll do it? No, you thought it worked that way. Congratulations. It doesn't. And folks, when managers use role power, that is, they tell versus ask in this case, we get what's known as compliance energy. Directs follow our directive because they know they must. But compliance energy generates very little creativity, inspiration, or extra effort. But when managers use relationship power, instead of relying on directing, telling, they rely on persuasion or selling. And when we use persuasion, we ask, we open up the opportunity for commitment energy. Why? Because directs who believe they can say no, honoring their agency as an individual, then bring to the task or deliverable commitment energy. Of course, following our wider guidance, we will have told our directs about the delegation model before we ever used it. And prior to ever using it, we will have stressed that what we're doing is asking a question, not making a statement. We're asking them to do something, not telling them to do it. And we'll also share the principle that ethical managers never ask a question of directs if we don't intend to honor the answer. Said more simply, I suppose, if you say no, I will respect it. I'm not going to veto that.
Right. I'll go ask somebody else.
Yeah.
Good. Florida Manager Tools is coming south next month. March 26th and 27th, we'll be hosting in Miami our EMC and ECC, 2 days of training focused on effective management and effective communication. March 26th and 27th in Miami. Sign up online at manager-tools.com/training. Come see us. The discussion about commitment versus compliant energy really addresses the conceptual underpinnings of the manager tools delegation model. And it brings up our fear, I think, one of the fears that managers have, which is the direct who says no to a delegation. And in this cast, specifically, we're talking about the direct who says no to a delegation because of workload.
Mm-hmm.
Please do remember that because we're asking, it is okay for our direct to say no to our ask. Otherwise, we'd be chipping away at our relationship. Ask with a role power tell, and soon our directs will learn to simply answer with what they thought we wanted to hear from them, which, as you might imagine, would set alight a bonfire any trust you had already gained through one-on-ones.
Why would you want to get rid of all that trust you gained? But here's how to respond to a workload-based decline to a delegation ask. So I ask this individual, would you be able to take over the running of this customer survey project? For example, we would recommend you respond by saying, okay, no problem. If it's too much, it's too much. But suppose we could make this workload neutral. Suppose we could look at your entire workload and either move something to somebody else or just stop doing something. If you're already at peak hours and can't see a way to get greater efficiency in your existing tasks, that's fine. But maybe there's stuff you're doing that I don't know about that I'd rate as having a much lower organizational value than you do. Or maybe there's stuff that someone else would kill to do, but you've already mastered it and you should be challenging yourself in other ways. If we could leave your hours alone, but take something away to make room for this, would you be up for it? And our data shows that if that's your response to, again, the pushback about I'm too busy, the majority of directs, admittedly not all, but the majority of directs gladly accept the delegation because they didn't know that was part of the deal. They didn't know, like, part of the deal was, I don't have time for this. oh, you're going to help me alleviate my workload concern. They just assumed this was another thing to add to the pile, not a replacement.
And then we've got to help them solve their problem.
That's true.
If it turns out they do have one. I will say this. What we're going to propose, I have been through a few times, and 25% of the time when I have done it for myself around my own workload, it was just how I felt about my workload.
Oh,
it wasn't
genius,
accurate
dude.
That my workload was too big. I remember having this conversation when I worked for Mark in New Jersey and saying to him, no way, absolutely not. Get out of here.
Can't do it.
I'm drowning. And it was definitely after I'd presented all day. It was 7 p.m. in New Jersey. And I remember there was snow. It was awful. It was February in New
Jersey.
There
was snow. It was terrible.
It was so cold and so hadn't gone out to dinner. I had just eaten French fries for dinner because I was so tired. And I made the list of all the stuff I was working on and realized, oh, no, I just feel.
Oh, I feel like there's a lot. Oh, dude, I do it. Same. I mean, that reverse engineering of this thing that we'd suggest you do with directs is incredibly helpful.
Yeah. For them and you.
Yeah. For them and you. Yeah. If you want to do it for yourself, you're like, I am literally dying. I am underwater over here. Do this next thing that Kate's going to tell you to do on yourself and it'll make you feel differently.
The water might not be that deep.
Yeah.
You might just feel you may be in like knee deep water, but just like crouched down. You could stand up. So what we're going to do from a conceptual process, and then I'll talk about exactly what to say, is to think of the problem as one of prioritization. Recall the principles we talked about earlier. What should this direct be working on? And what are they working on that you just don't care about?
Yeah.
What tens of thousands of managers have discovered over the last years, 20 years, 30 years of using, I guess 40, if it depends on when you're listening to this, of using manager tools models, is managers are shocked by how their directs spend their time.
Mm-hmm.
In a very terrible example, a direct once said, oh, I don't work on what's important. I work on what's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I actually talked to someone once who told me that instead of using like a program to create diagrams, they were actually physically cutting out shapes to make diagrams.
Oh my gosh, I remember this.
Yeah, it was terrible. Yeah, it was really, whew. So somewhere somebody's cutting out rectangles.
Pasting them to pieces of paper.
Oh, okay. So here's how that conversation might sound. And keep in mind, it doesn't have to be immediately following the delegation decline.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
may need time to think through all of their work to capture it in the list. So here's what you say. You say, okay, let's start with what you're working on. Best estimates for what tasks and deliverables you own and how much time you spend on them each week. And keep in mind that we have to account for email, some sense of the meetings you spend time in. Keep in mind that everything you're doing is going to be compared to what I'm asking you to do that's new. So is this higher or lower priority? We've all got to change and grow. We also need to be ready to reassess priorities as the company and its markets change. You and I need to be on the same page. And this discussion actually might give us a chance to get there. Don't worry about your prioritization being wrong. That's really not the point here. You probably did what we all do and established priorities and didn't regularly relook at them as the work became, you know, part of your general workload for accuracy in light of changing conditions. And we'll figure that out.
Exactly. And folks, it doesn't matter whether or not the estimates they provide you are precise. It's incredibly unlikely, in fact, that what they provide you will be precise. What you want to know is what they spend the majority of their time on. Now, a couple of things. One, going back to what Kate and I were saying a moment earlier, we've both done this activity, reverse engineered it, on ourselves, only to discover, wow, I'm actually not that busy. What that means to you is, if you got a direct that says, in response to this provision of a list, says to you, yeah, you know what? I spent some time thinking about it. I can make this work. I really don't need the list. It's okay. Like, it's okay. They're essentially admitting that they sat down and tried to create the list and there were like six things on it. So just so you know that, like, if they refuse to provide you a list, because this has happened to me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If they refuse to provide you a list, it's because they sat down, they discovered what Kate and I both have discovered for ourselves. that there are really not that many things on the list, but they want to keep employing the busyness model that I'm so busy. So their response to you might sound like, hey, you know what? I've thought about it. I can make this fit. I don't need to do the list. Exactly. They're trying to employ this busyness model by not giving you the insight you've asked for into their workload, having discovered that their workload actually isn't a problem. They're trying to continue to hide from you this busyness or lack thereof by not giving you full view into how busy or not they are. So I would suggest if they refuse to give you the list, you insist on the list at that point. Because
that's totally valid.
There's some obscurity happening there that is maybe a little bit, you should dig. You should just dig a little
bit. And I will say my experience with this was not that there wasn't a lot of stuff on the list. It was that I felt that it was more than it was. Like I felt like it was bigger. So that could happen too. And they could show you the list and say, hey, I was wrong. Actually, I made this list and I feel differently now because my experience is if you make the list, you realize what's really happening as opposed to just experiencing your feelings of stress, which have all kinds of other stuff going on, right? Home life. It's
totally
cold and horrible and you haven't eaten in New Jersey.
Right. Yeah. How disorganized your desk looks at the current moment. I mean, there are a lot of things that play into our feeling frantic that make us feel busier than we truly are. And remember, when you and your direct disagree on the relative prioritization of their tasks and the time that they actually spend completing those tasks, your analysis overrules their analysis. And this is a great opportunity for you to share your thinking about how much time they ought to be spending on certain tasks. Many of us accept our own biases and preferences in how we structure our work. But you might discover, oh my gosh, you're spending how much time on what? Oh, dude, you shouldn't be spending more than an hour a week on that. Look at that magical 3 hours. Like you want to remember, you are responsible for this high-level prioritization of their work. They don't just get to choose to spend 4 hours on something that you know should only take an hour.
They love spreadsheets, though.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They love spreadsheets. So this gets to the point. There's nothing wrong with taking away something that they love to do, but really isn't as valuable to the organization as it used to be. Some of this stuff could be considered for automation, by the way. We talk sometimes about there's automation, delegation, and elimination. So there's something there too. There's nothing wrong with telling them to stop doing something from which there is still value and not as much value as something that's new or different. There's nothing wrong with stopping doing altogether something which is necessary, but not as necessary as what you're asking them to take on. There's also nothing wrong with asking them to stop doing something for a limited amount of time to assess its urgency. I find if you ask them to stop doing something and they feel that it's important and no one can, and you say, you know what, just 3 weeks, just give me 3 weeks of this extra time and then we can go back to it. And if nobody notices for 3 weeks, you're probably cool. When I first started working here, there's a report and I was supposed to put it out every Thursday morning. And 1 week I did the fonts. The font was insane. I don't know what I did. I have no idea. But when you opened it, the font had to be something in the 250 size. It was
like a lot, like a letter a page.
Full, and it was an Excel sheet. It was an export. And to look at it was to be baffled immediately. Yeah. And I produced it. I put it in the folder.
Didn't look at it. Obviously, didn't like do like a pass to see the issue.
I think I meant to do like a command, like a shift command S.
Yeah.
And instead, like, or I didn't get it all the way from CSV to Excel or something.
Yeah, something.
But I had done it and it was saved. And I all I did was the font was just off. Like I tried to change the font instead of putting like 28, I put like 280 or something.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
I don't know. The thing is nobody noticed.
Nobody noticed.
And so then the next week I did the same thing and nobody noticed. And 6 weeks in a row, nobody noticed. So it's been 9 years. And I haven't done it. So also though, don't do stuff that's going to get you in trouble. Like I'm not trying to get people in trouble, but it's also not your job to not get in trouble.
Right. Yeah. Like
it's your job to get in trouble for the right things.
For the right things. That's the thing. All of our organizations are structured in such a way that there's more work to do than people to do them. You're just fully. Meant to, yeah, right, if your company's going to stay in business. And in terms of your stoppage of work, it is absolutely possible that what you're trying to delegate does not justify making changes to what someone else is working on. And that's fine too. You can consider delegating it to somebody else on the team. Your job isn't to know all the answers to all of the things immediately. It's just to consider what priorities are and try and make some value judgments with a low-ish degree of risk. So the lesson here for delegating is, now that you understand the hollowness of the busyness defense, you can address it ethically from the point of view of the organization and its growth. And growth comes from people growth.
Y'all, busyness is such an easy defense.
Mm-hmm. It's so easy.
It is. If you understand the weakness of the argument, you can be a leader who overcomes that argument, a powerful leader. And it doesn't have to be seen as a battle of wills that will cause friction. You don't have to see it as a situation that only leads to trust being drained out of a relationship, because now that you know what to do, you can do what you're supposed to do, growing and developing your team for the right reasons with the right tactics.
Exactly. That's all for this week, folks. Thank you so much for joining us for this important topic. We will see you next week with a brand new topic.
Thanks, y'all. Have a great week.
Bye, everyone.